From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
These kinds of threats are real and require the attention of the senior level officials at each of these agencies.
That was the sound of the press and White House staff being told to evacuate during the presidential press secretary's daily briefing Tuesday. Reports were that a bomb scare was the cause. After a short time, the media was allowed back into the briefing room. That bomb scare followed another one earlier in the day at the Dirksen Senate office building on Capitol Hill. That building was evacuated and one entrance closed after Capitol Police reportedly received a call about a suspicious package in one room. The building was reopened shortly thereafter. At the same time, Capitol Police responded to a report of yet another suspicious package at the Russell Senate office building, which turned out, according to reports, to be an unattended cooler. Fresh Saudi airstrikes on Yemen resulted in more civilian casualties. Press TV's Bardia Honardar has more.
Saudi Arabia's warplanes have pounded positions in northern Yemen, wreaking havoc and causing civilian casualties. Three women lost their lives in the latest bombardment of the northern Saada province. The air raid targeted the Maran district shortly after a similar attack in Hidan district, where no casualties have been reported. Earlier, Saudi fighter jets targeted positions in the northwestern Hajja province. A gas station was pounded there. Riyadh's aggression against Yemen has claimed nearly 4,200 lives since late March. We're now joined by our correspondent, Mohammed Al-Attab, who's with us via satellite from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Mohammed, please bring us up to speed on the recent Saudi aggression against Yemen and also about the retaliatory attacks carried out close to the border with Saudi Arabia.
Yes, the Saudi Arabia has intensified its air bombardment of different Yemeni cities, particularly in Saada, as it has witnessed what the observers say indiscriminate air bombardment, where several casualties have also been inflicted on the presidential areas there. I have just met one of the people who have fled the Saada. He said that their village has been totally destroyed. It's called Sabr village, which has witnessed fierce air bombardments. Those people are normal people. They are not affiliated to any party. That they are being also targeted by the Saudi army. They say that these kind of air strikes are indiscriminately targeting every Yemeni citizen in the country, especially the Saada region. Also, they have bombarded the different areas in Harab, Maidi, which are on the border with the Saudi Arabia. But so far, also, they have targeted these residential areas in Sana'a. They claim that they are former officials of Yemeni officials. But human rights activists say that even though they are political activists or officers, their houses shouldn't be targeted and their families shouldn't be killed. They say that this is a genocidal war that hasn't taken place in any in the world's history so far. The rooftops of these families have been collided over their residence, over the dwellers of these houses. So Yemeni human rights activists are calling on the international community to put an end to this kind of genocidal war, which hasn't taken place in the world's history. These kinds of reprisal operations and also retaliatory operations, which are being conducted against the Saudi army, where they have defeated the Saudi army and the Tuwailuq military position in the border of these Yemeni and Saudi borders. These kind of reprisal operations have taken place place after nearly 30 days of continued Saudi bombardments. Yemeni people waited for the international community to put an end to this kind of international violation to the United Nations resolutions and also the principles of the United Nations as it has been founded and established in order to prevent such violations to its the laws and norms, but so far these kinds of international silence has been slammed by Yemeni human rights activists. Also, these kinds of attempts by Saudi Arabia in order to incite a sectarian war within Yemen has been also foiled by the Yemeni army and the popular units, where in Al Jouf there are militants who have been defeated in Khab al-Sha'af and also Al-Yatama, which was one of the latest and the last attempts by Riyadh in order to have this kind of sectarian war on Yemen. Yemen has proved itself as a hard number for this kind of plots against its own soil and its Indeed. Own nation. Yemenis are now united more than ever against Saudi Arabia and its attempts for inciting sectarian war, as it is, many observers say, it's doing in other places in the Arab world.
Monday saw the close of the G7 meeting in Germany's Bavarian Alps. According to the New York Times, President Obama might have preferred that the summit of the seven leading industrial nations was fully focused on big issues like climate change and global trade, but instead the meeting was largely overshadowed by crisis diplomacy as the president and his counterparts chose to concentrate on the Islamic State and the claim of Russian involvement in fighting in Ukraine. President Obama headed for home Monday with vague promises from European leaders to reduce global emissions of greenhouse gases, and he said the leaders he had met with were united in their efforts to expand free trade. But that unity was nowhere in sight Tuesday as a vote on the U.S.-EU Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, was delayed at the last minute in the European Parliament due to divisions within the two major party groups, forcing the president of the assembly, Martin Schulz, to postpone it. The last-minute delay was attributed to the many amendments to the proposal, which MPs said required more study. But there is strong opposition to the TTIP across Europe, both among government officials and the public. Opponents say the treaty will only benefit big corporations at the expense of the public. In any event, the G7 agenda at the sprawling resort in the shadow of the Bavarian Alps was in the main dominated by security issues. Despite the focus on Cold War rhetoric, Greece was at the center stage outside of the formal conference on Monday, as the country's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, delivered a speech on the crisis in the Eurozone to a number of senior officials that placed the European economic situation into the heart of the summit. We'll have part two of that speech later in this newscast. The government of Palestine is pressing ahead to bring war crimes charges against Israel at The Hague. Riyad al-Maliki, Palestine's minister of foreign affairs, said Tuesday that two lawsuits would be submitted to the International Criminal Court on June 25th. He said the legal actions are over Israel's illegal settlement activities in the occupied West Bank and its latest devastating war on the besieged Gaza Strip. Tel Aviv's military operations against Gaza last summer left over 2,000 Palestinians dead and thousands of others injured. Israel and the U.S. have threatened to fight any proceedings against Tel Aviv. Palestinians formally became a member of the ICC on April 1st. Meanwhile, talks between Israel and China over migrant workers deadlocked over Beijing's refusal to allow its citizens to participate in the construction of settlements in the occupied West Bank. That, according to a French news report, which said the source was an unnamed but high-ranking Israeli official. It quoted the official as saying Israel was negotiating with China for an agreement on the arrival of thousands of additional workers, but that, among several stumbling blocks to the talks, is the issue of, quote, the employment of these immigrants in settlements in Judea and Samaria, closed quote, both of which are in the West Bank. The unnamed Israeli official reportedly claimed that China's position has nothing to do with the growing international call for an economic and cultural boycott of Israel, although he admitted it was likely linked to Beijing's diplomatic position supporting the creation of a Palestinian state and opposing Israel's presence in the occupied Palestinian territories. The international community has termed all Israeli settlements built on the land it seized from Palestine during the 1967 Six-Day War as illegal. Israel seeks to attract thousands of migrant workers to speed up construction in the occupied West Bank and elsewhere across the country. Last month's municipal primary elections in Philadelphia saw a record low turnout among Democrats that some say are a bad sign for the party's presidential nominee in 2016. Glenn Ford from BlackAgendaReport.com discussed the election with Dr. Anthony Montero, an activist and former faculty member in the Department of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. Dr. Montero was also a lifelong resident of the city of brotherly love.
Recent local elections in Philadelphia saw the lowest voter turnout in living memory. In some of the poorest black precincts, turnout barely reached 10% of registered voters. Dr. Tony Montero is an activist, a scholar, and a native Philadelphian. Montero thinks the non-voting majority is sending a message.
Well, I think people recognized that the city has been run, whether the mayor is white like Ed Rendell or black like Wilson Good, John Street, and Michael Nutter. The city has been run for the 1%. Philadelphia is building a town while neighborhoods are in decline and public schools are being shut down and poverty increases and extreme poverty increases at even a more rapid pace than poverty itself is increasing. So people had no stake in this, and I think they were expressing their profound and I would say legitimate rejection of the governing classes of the city of Philadelphia, be they black, white, Hispanic, or otherwise.
Well, this record-breaking level of non-involvement by the Democratic base does not augur well for the Democratic Party nationally or for Hillary Clinton's chances in Pennsylvania in 2016.
No question about it. Hillary Clinton or any other Democrat cannot win the state of Pennsylvania without a huge black turnout and 90% of the black electorate voting for the Democratic candidate. I don't think that's going to happen. If I were to make a prediction based upon what happened Tuesday here in Philadelphia, Hillary Clinton cannot win the state of Pennsylvania. And if Hillary Clinton cannot win the state of Pennsylvania, she cannot become the president of the United States.
Have we entered a period in which the Democratic Party is incapable, because of its ties to the bankers, of offering anything of substance to its base, especially black people?
To that period, I think we have entered the period where there is a crisis of legitimacy, what political scientists call a crisis of legitimacy, where those who govern no longer have the legitimate support of the people that they govern. The question is, how will they govern without the support of the people and still call it democracy? I think we are in a crisis, a political crisis, the likes of which we have not experienced, perhaps since the Civil War.
Dr. Tony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia.
This past Monday, we followed up with Dr. Montero on ways of using the ability to deny Pennsylvania to Clinton or other Democratic nominees as leverage for the community, for housing, jobs, and the issues with the police, using power at the margins to force the hand of both the national Democratic ticket and also local Democratic officials like the governor, who have a stake in the outcome of the presidential election. So I saw the piece, I heard the piece rather, that you did with Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Report last week, and you made an observation about the fact, or you stated essentially the fact that in order for a 2016 presidential election to be won by either party, really, they have to carry Pennsylvania, particularly the Democrats, and they can't carry it without Philadelphia, which made me think about Philadelphia as a pivot point for the 2016 election and maybe a focal point for organizing. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. That's what I think. I think Philadelphia could be one of, if not the key to victory for Hillary Clinton, or the key to her defeat. And I was basing my observation upon what happened in the May 19th primary elections, which effectively chose who will be the next mayor of the city of Philadelphia, because the Democrats so outnumber the Republicans that literally who wins the Democratic primary ends up winning the election in November.
Right, like many cities, yeah.
Yes.
So, okay, so, and that rested on turnout, right? Wasn't there record low turnout?
Yes, there was. And this is what is so profound about the election on May 19th. My friend and I estimate that the turnout was about 23% of the registered voters. Now, of course, the registered voters don't include all of the potential electorate,
right,
because you have a large number of people in Philadelphia, especially young people and poor people, who are not registered to vote and therefore outside of the electoral process. However, of the registered voters, 23%, about 23.5% of them turned out, which means that close to 77% of the registered voters did not turn out. This is the lowest turnout in any election, primary or general election, in decades, maybe since numbers have been kept on voter turnout in Philadelphia.
The state of Pennsylvania is very important to Democratic candidates to in a national election. Is just a low turnout enough to swing the state?
Yeah, a low black turnout in Philadelphia would be enough to deny Hillary Clinton Pennsylvania.
Now, looking at the general state of both the economy and the political economy in the United States, looking towards next year, one does not have high hopes for there being a reversal of the deteriorating conditions for people in Philadelphia and elsewhere. So, assuming that a turnaround isn't going to reignite interest in the political system, what kind of campaigning, giving people hope instead of bread, can be? You think people are going to try to utilize to try to mobilize the base?
Well, I think that's the role of Bernie Sanders to mobilize the base around progressive issues, or at least progressive-sounding issues, and then herd them into the Hillary Clinton campaign. I don't think it's going to work. I mean, especially when it comes to young people. You know, young people were a major part of both of Barack Obama's electoral victories in 2008 and 2012. In Philadelphia, young people have pretty much made the decision that they're not into elections, and if they're into anything, it is marches and civil disobedience and movement building. They don't trust politicians. In fact, they don't trust hardly any of what are established leaders in the black community. So I think that as far as Philadelphia is concerned, no candidate is going to be able to come here and campaign without facing a demonstration, some kind of civil disobedience, or the like.
And in terms of building something, let's, you know, on the one hand, you may see people organizing so that they can exert power at the margins. First, do they take that and say, okay, look, Hillary Clinton, or whoever it is, we just demonstrated that we can deny you the election. Come talk to us. Do you think that kind of horse trading will go on? And, you know, then, of course, it's who does the negotiating for the side of the people in the streets?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think that one of the things that should be bargained over is a promise or commitment to release Mumia on grounds of his health and on grounds that he has served more than enough time in exchange for the movement not calling upon black people to stay home. I think that's a bargaining chip. There are other things that could be bargained over. Now, the question of who will be the bargainers from our side, I couldn't say who they might be. But we have some leverage in this election. And the other side of it is, you know, the Democratic National Convention is going to be here in Philadelphia in the summer of 2016.
That's right. That's a lot of leverage, because if you pull half the city out to demonstrate against the Democratic convention in a city that the Democrats have to win, it's a very powerful statement on the global, on the national stage, at least. And looking, you know, past the demands like getting Mumia freed finally, which I guess would have to be made to the governor as
right.
Then. I assume that the dissatisfaction that people feel in Philadelphia is, you know, deeper than that, and that there are some changes that they would like to make in their own conditions that are not going to be handed down from Washington, certainly, and even if they're promised, once the election goes by, the leverage is gone. What kind of constructive actions are people considering or can people take to empower themselves so that after they have whatever impact they have on the election, they're still on the process of rebuilding their communities?
Yeah, you know, everything. For example, you know, the state has ultimate control over the schools in Philadelphia. One of the big demands is that local control be returned over to the people of Philadelphia, over our public education system. Another thing having to do with public education is a moratorium and eventually an end to this rampant privatization and the reclaiming of the physical resources of the public school system. In other words, the buildings and so on. Another big demand for the people specifically of Philadelphia is a end to the 10-year tax abatement for gentrifiers and real estate developers.
Yeah.
And a reversal of the tax burden from the shoulders of ordinary homeowners and taxpayers to the corporate structures and to the gentrifiers and real estate developers. Other demands I would say would have to do with some commitment to full employment. Now that's a national commitment which would affect Philadelphia, and a youth jobs program. So those are, you know, the range of possibilities of demands are broad as they relate to Philadelphia. You know, we also have coming up here this month the U.S. Social Forum, and hopefully some of the planning for 2016 will take place there, and some of the demands that should be put forward will be developed at the U.S. Social Forum.
Despite an uneventful G7 conference and the Cold War rhetoric from Washington, Greece was at the center stage Monday, and the European economic situation was placed at the heart of the discussion as the country's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, delivered a speech on the crisis in the Eurozone. We bring you today part two of that speech.
It is this vicious cycle that our government was elected a few months ago to put an end to. The moment we were elected, we went to the institutions, to our partners, and we said to them, you may think what you like of us. We have a name that jars badly amongst conservative and even social democratic parties everywhere. We are the radical left party. We don't expect you to like that. But at least we are bringing to you an important asset. We are not corrupt. We have not received a single euro from the corrupt powers that be in Greece to be elected. We run a shoestring campaign. We have no obligations to them. Use us. Work with us in order to end corruption in Greece. The first Eurogroup that I attended, I put forward a proposal to my fellow finance ministers, and it was this. The negotiations between our side and your side is going to be protracted, because we are challenging the very logic of the 5 years of MOU programs for Greece. But you and I, we agree on a number of things. We agree on tax evasion. We agree on corruption. We agree that the pension system needs to be reformed. We agree that we have oligarchy in Greece. We agree that we have oligopolistic practices that need to be put to an end. We agree that the bureaucracy needs to be revamped. Why don't we agree on the basis of that agreement on 3 or 4 pieces of legislation that we can push through Greek Parliament? We have the authority to do that. The Greek people have vested it to us. Why don't we agree to do this? And meanwhile, we're continuing the negotiation. I was told in no uncertain terms by the institutions and by the Eurogroup, forget it. We are not going to have a piecemeal approach. There has to be a full and comprehensive review. Everything has to be accepted, decided jointly with the institutions, and then and only then will you put everything through your parliament. And if you do it on your own, this will be considered a unilateral action, which is equivalent to casus belli. So we went along. We wanted to play along. We wanted to be cooperative. So we entered into the full comprehensive review. But there were 3 impediments to the conclusion of these negotiations, which are still impeding their conclusion. The first one is economically unsustainable numbers. If you look at the previous programs and if you look at the proposals of the institutions now, on the fiscal side of the Greek equation, there are 3 important numbers. One is the projected growth rate, which is necessary to grow the economy in order to be able to repay our debts and to service our people. Growth rate, variable number one. Variable number two, the primary surplus. That is, what is left to the Greek state after it has paid for all its expenditures, except for debt repayments. Thirdly, tax measures and benefit measures, pension measures, and all that. These 3 numbers, so growth rate, primary surplus, and fiscal numbers, fiscal measures, think of them as 3 variables in a system of 3 equations which you are trying to solve. The idea that Greece, after having received the largest loans in human history in order to mask, to disguise the unsustainability of the previous loans on condition of austerity, that it reduced our income by a quarter, that logic now leads us to a situation where the institutions are insisting that in order to pretend further that our debts are sustainable, we have to promise primary surpluses that are so large that the growth rate they're assuming to be necessary cannot be produced, because those primary surpluses are like me as a finance minister reaching into the guts, into the heart, into the substance of the private sector and extracting so much out of it that the private sector cannot produce the growth, which is then essential for this equation or system of equations to be solved.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.